grandfather's dying wish, contented himself with being a mere farmer. His death left you alone in the world, so the time has come for you to stand on your own feet.
Yes, sir.
You must become a great man.
I'll try.
Tears sprang to his eyes. For 3 generations, this house sheltered your family from wind and rain. Say your thanks to it, then say goodbye, once and for all, and have no regrets. Musashi went inside and set fire to the hovel. When he came out, Iori was blinking back his tears. If we left the house standing, said Musashi, it'll only become a hideout for highwaymen or common thieves. I'm burning it to keep men like that from desecrating the memory of your father and grandfather.
I'm grateful.
The shack turned into a small mountain of fire, then collapsed.
Let's go,
said Iori, no longer concerned with relics of the past.
Not yet.
There's nothing else to do here, is there?
Musashi laughed.
We're going to build a new house on that knoll over there.
New house? What for? You just burned the old one down.
That belonged to your father and grandfather. The one we build will be for us.
You mean we're going to stay here?
That's right.
We're not going away somewhere and train and discipline ourselves?
We'll do that here.
What can we train ourselves for here?
To be swordsmen, to be samurai.
We'll discipline our spirits and work hard to make ourselves into real human beings.
Come with me and bring that axe with you.
He pointed to a clump of grass where he had put the farm tools. Shouldering the axe, Iori followed Musashi to the knoll, where there were a few chestnut trees, pines, and cryptomerias. Musashi, stripping to the waist, took the axe and went to work. Soon he was sending up a veritable shower of white chips of raw wood. Iori watched, thinking, maybe he's going to build a dojo. Or are we going to practice out in the open? One tree fell, then another, and another. Sweat poured down Musashi's ruddy cheeks, washing away the lethargy and loneliness of the past few days. He had conceived of his present plan while standing by the farmer's fresh grave in the tiny burial ground. I'll lay down my sword for a time, he had decided, and work with a hoe instead. Zen, calligraphy, the art of tea, painting pictures and carving statues were all useful in perfecting one's swordsmanship. Couldn't tilling a field also contribute to his training? Wasn't this broad tract of earth waiting for someone to bring it under cultivation a perfect training hall? By changing inhospitable flatlands into farmlands, he would also be promoting the welfare of future generations. He'd lived his whole life like a mendicant Zen priest, on the receiving end, so to speak, depending on other people for food, shelter, and donations. He wanted to make a change, a radical one, since he'd long suspected that only those who had actually grown their own grain and vegetables really understood how sacred and valuable they were. Those who hadn't were like priests who did not practice what they preached, or swordsmen who learned combat techniques but knew nothing of the way. As a boy, he had been taken by his mother into the fields and had worked alongside the tenants and villagers. His purpose now, however, was more than just to produce food for his daily meals. He sought nourishment for his soul. He wanted to learn what it meant to work for a living, rather than beg for one. He also wanted to implant his own way of thinking among the people of the district. As he saw it, by surrendering the land to weeds and thistles, and giving in to storms and floods, they were passing on their hand-to-mouth existence from generation to generation without ever opening their eyes to their own potentialities and those of the land around them.
Iori, he called, get some rope and tie up this timber, then drag it down to the riverbank.
When that was done, Musashi propped his axe against the tree and wiped the sweat off his forehead with his elbow. He then went down and stripped the bark off the trees with a hatchet. When darkness fell, They built a bonfire with the scraps and found blocks of wood to use as pillows.
"Interesting work, isn't it?" said Musashi.
With perfect honesty, Iori answered, "I don't think it's interesting at all. I didn't have to become your pupil to learn how to do this."
"You'll like it better as time goes on."
As autumn waned, the insect voices faded into silence. Leaves withered and fell. Musashi and Iori finished their cabin and addressed themselves to the task of making the land ready for planting. One day, while he was surveying the land, Musashi suddenly found himself thinking it was like a diagram of the social unrest that lasted for a century after the Onin War. Such thoughts aside, it was not an encouraging picture. Unknown to Musashi, Hotengahara had over the centuries been buried many times by volcanic ash from Mount Fuji, and the Tone River had repeatedly flooded the flatlands. When the weather was fair, the land became bone dry, but whenever there were heavy rains, the water carved out new channels, carrying great quantities of dirt and rock along with it. There was no principal stream into which the smaller ones flowed naturally, the nearest thing to this being a wide basin that lacked sufficient capacity to either water or drain the area as a whole. The most urgent need was obvious, to bring the water under control. Still, the more he had looked, the more he had questioned why the area was undeveloped. "It won't be easy," he thought, excited by the challenge it posed. Joining water and earth to create productive fields was not much different from leading men and women in such a way that civilization might bloom. To Musashi, it seemed that his goal was in complete agreement with his ideals of swordsmanship. He had come to see the way of the sword in a new light. A year or two earlier, he had wanted only to conquer all rivals, but now the idea that the sword existed for the purpose of giving him power over other people was unsatisfying. To cut people down, to triumph over them, to display the limits of one's strength, seemed increasingly vain. He wanted to conquer himself, to make life itself submit to him, to cause people to live rather than die. The way of the sword should not be used merely for his own perfection. It should be a source of strength for governing people and leading them to peace and happiness. He realized his grand ideals were no more than dreams, and would remain so as long as he lacked the political authority to implement them. But here in this wasteland, he needed neither rank nor power. He plunged into the struggle with joy and enthusiasm. Day in and day out, stumps were uprooted, gravel sifted, land leveled, soil and rocks made into dikes. Musashi and Iori worked from before dawn until after the stars were shining bright in the sky. Their relentless toil attracted attention. Villagers passing by often stopped, stared, and commented. "What do they think they're doing? How can they live in a place like that? Isn't the boy old Sangemon's son?" Everyone laughed, but not all let it go at that. One man came out of genuine kindness and said, "I hate to tell you this, but you're wasting your time. You can break your backs making a field here, but one storm and it'll be gone overnight." When he saw that they were still at it several days later, he seemed a bit offended. "All you're doing here, I tell you, is making a lot of water holes where they won't do any good." A few days later, he concluded that the strange samurai was short on brains. "Fools!" he shouted in disgust. The next day brought a whole group to heckle. "If anything could grow here, we wouldn't sweat under the blazing sun working our own fields, poor as they are. We'd sit home and play the flute.
And there wouldn't be any famines. You're digging up the place for nothing. Got the sense of a pile of manure."
Still hoeing, Musashi kept his eyes on the ground and grinned. Iori was less complacent, though Musashi had earlier scolded him for taking the peasants seriously.
Sir, he pouted, they all say the same thing.
Pay no attention.
I can't help it,
he cried, seizing a rock to throw at their tormentors. An angry glare from Musashi stopped him.
Now what good do you think that would do? If you don't behave yourself, I'm not going to have you as my pupil.
Iori's ears burned at the rebuke, but instead of dropping the rock, he cursed and hurled it at a boulder. The rock gave off sparks as it cracked in two. Iori tossed his hoe aside and began to weep. Musashi ignored him, though he wasn't unmoved.
He's all alone, just as I am, he thought.
As though in sympathy with the boy's grief, a twilight breeze swept over the plain, setting everything astir. The sky darkened and raindrops fell.
Come on, Iori, let's go in, called Musashi. Looks like we're in for a squall.
Hurriedly, collecting his tools, he ran for the house. By the time he was inside, the rain was coming down in gray sheets.
Iori!
He shouted, surprised that the boy had not come with him. He went to the window and strained his eyes toward the field. Rain spattered from the sill into his face. A streak of lightning split the air and struck the earth. As he shut his eyes and put his hands over his ears, he felt the force of the thunder. In the wind and rain, Musashi saw the cryptomeria tree at the Shippoji and heard the stern voice of Takuan. He felt that whatever he had gained since then, he owed to them. He wanted to possess the tree's immense strength, as well as Takuan's icy, unwavering compassion. If he could be to Iori what the old cryptomeria had been to him, he would feel he'd succeeded in repaying a part of his debt to the monk.
Iori! Iori!
There was no answer, only thunder and the rain pounding on the roof.
Where could he have gone?
He wondered, still unwilling to venture outside. When the rain slackened to a drizzle, he did go out. Iori had not moved an inch. With his clothing clinging to his body and his face still screwed up in an angry frown, he looked rather like a scarecrow. How could a child be so stubborn?
Idiot! Musashi chided. Get back into the house! Being drenched like that's not exactly good for you. Hurry up before rivers start forming. Then you won't be able to get back.
Iori turned, as though trying to locate Musashi's voice, then started laughing.
Something bothering you? This kind of rain doesn't last. See? The clouds are breaking up already.
Musashi, not expecting to receive a lesson from his pupil, was more than a little put out. But Iori didn't give the matter a second thought.
Come on, the boy said, picking up his hoe. We can still get quite a bit done before the sun's gone.
For the next 5 days, bulbuls and shrikes conversed hoarsely under a cloudless blue sky, and great cracks grew in the earth as it caked around the roots of the rushes. On the sixth day, a cluster of small black clouds appeared on the horizon and rapidly spread across the heavens until the whole plain seemed to be under an eclipse. Iori studied the sky briefly and said in a worried tone, "This time, it's the real thing." Even as he spoke, an inky wind swirled around them. Leaves shook, and little birds dropped to the earth as if felled by a silent and invisible horde of hunters.
Another shower? Musashi asked.
Not with a sky like that. I'd better go to the village, and you'd better gather up the tools and get inside as fast as you can.
Before Musashi could ask why, Iori took off across the flatlands and was quickly lost in a sea of high grass. Again, Iori's weather sense was accurate. The sudden downpour, driven by a raging, gusty wind that sent Musashi scurrying for shelter, developed its own distinctive rhythms. The rain fell in unbelievable quantity for a time, stopped suddenly, then recommenced with even greater fury. Night came, but the storm continued unabated. It began to seem as though the heavens were set on making the entire earth into an ocean. Several times, Musashi feared that the wind would rip off the roof. The floor was already littered with shingles torn off its underside. Morning came, gray and formless and with no sign of Iori. Musashi stood by the window and his heart sank. He could do nothing. Here and there, a tree or a clump of grass was visible. All else was a vast, muddy swamp. Luckily, the cabin was still above water level, but in what had been a dry riverbed, immediately below it, there was now a rushing torrent, carrying along everything in its path. Not knowing for sure that Iori hadn't fallen into the water and drowned, Musashi felt time drag on, until finally he thought he heard Iori's voice calling, "Sensei! Here!" He was some distance beyond the river, riding a bullock, with a great bundle tied behind him. Musashi watched in consternation as Iori strode straight into the muddy flow, which seemed about to suck him under at every step. When he gained the other bank, he was quaking from the cold and wet, but he calmly guided the bullock to the side of the cabin. "Where have you been?" demanded Musashi, his voice both angry and relieved. "To the village, of course. I brought back lots of food. It'll rain half a year's worth before this storm's over, and when it is, we'll be trapped by the floodwaters." After they had taken the straw bundle inside, Iori untied it and removed the items one by one from the inner wrapping of oiled paper. "Here are some chestnuts, lentil beans, salted fish. We shouldn't run out of food even if it takes a month or two for the water to go down." Musashi's eyes misted over with gratitude, but he said nothing. He was too abashed at his own lack of common sense. How could he guide humanity if he was careless about his own survival? Were it not for Iori, he would now be facing starvation, and the boy, having been raised in a remote rural area, must have known about laying in supplies since he was 2 years old. It struck Musashi as odd that the villagers had agreed to furnish all this food. They couldn't have had very much for themselves. When he recovered his voice and raised the question, Iori replied, "I left my money pouch in Hawk and borrowed from the Tokuganji."
"And what's the Tokuganji?"
"It's the temple about 2 miles from here. My father told me there was some powdered gold in the pouch. He said if I got into difficulty, I should use it a little at a time. Yesterday, when the weather turned bad, I remembered what he said."
Iori wore a smile of triumph. "Isn't the pouch a keepsake from your father?"
"Yes. Now that we've burned the old house down, that and the sword are the only things left." He rubbed the hilt of the short weapon in his obi. Though the tang bore no craftsman's signature, Musashi had noted when he'd examined the blade earlier that it was of excellent quality. He also had the feeling that the inherited pouch had some significance beyond that of the powdered gold it contained.
"You shouldn't hand keepsakes over to other people. One of these days, I'll get it back for you. But after that, you must promise not to let go of it."
"Yes, sir."
"Where did you spend the night?"
"The priest told me I'd better wait there till morning."
"Have you eaten?"
"No. You haven't either, have you?"
"No, but there's no firewood, is there?"
"Oh, there's plenty."
He pointed downward, indicating the space under the cabin, where he'd stored a good supply of sticks and roots and bamboo picked up while he worked in the fields. Holding a piece of straw matting over his head, Musashi crawled under the cabin and again marveled at the boy's good sense. In an environment like this, survival depended on foresight, and a small mistake could spell the difference between life and death. When they had finished eating, Iori brought out a book. Then, kneeling formally before his teacher, he said,
"While we're waiting for the water to go down so we can work, would you teach me some reading and writing?"
Musashi agreed. On such a dismal, stormy day, it was a good way to pass the time. The book was a volume of the Analects of Confucius. Iori said it had been given to him at the temple. "Do you really want to study?"
"Yes."
"Have you done much reading?"
"No, only a little."
"Who taught you?"
"My father."
What have you read?
The Lesser Learning.
Did you enjoy it?
Yes, very much,
he said eagerly, his eyes brightening.
All right, then. I'll teach you all I know. Later on, you can find somebody better educated to teach you what I don't know.
They devoted the rest of the day to a study session, the boy reading aloud, Musashi stopping him to correct him or explain words he did not understand. They sat in utter concentration, oblivious of the storm. The deluge lasted 2 more days, by which time there was no land visible anywhere. On the following day, it was still raining. Iori, delighted, took out the book again and said,
"Shall we begin?"
"Not today. You've had enough of reading for a while."
"Why?"
"If you do nothing but read, you'll lose sight of the reality around you. Why don't you take the day off and play? I'm going to relax, too."
"But I can't go outside."
"Then just do like me," said Musashi, sprawling on his back and crossing his arms under his head.
"Do I have to lie down?"
"Do what you want. Lie down, stand up, sit, whatever's comfortable."
"Then what?"
"I'll tell you a story."
"I'd like that,"
said Iori, flopping down on his stomach and wiggling his legs in the air.
"What kind of story?"
"Let me see," said Musashi, going over the tales he had liked to hear as a child. He chose the one about the battles between the Genji and the Heike. All boys love that. Iori proved to be no exception. When Musashi came to the part about the Genji being defeated and the Heike taking over the country, the boy's face became gloomy. He had to blink to keep from crying over Lady Tokiwa's sad fate. But his spirits rose as he heard about Minamoto no Yoshitsune learning swordsmanship from the long-nosed goblins on Mount Kurama and later making his escape from Kyoto.
"I like Yoshitsune," he said, sitting up. "Are there really goblins on Mount Kurama?"
"Maybe. Anyway, there are people in this world who might as well be goblins. But the ones who taught Yoshitsune weren't real goblins."
"What were they?"
"Loyal vassals of the defeated Genji. They couldn't come out in the open while the Heike were in power, so they stayed hidden in the mountains until their chance came."
"Like my grandfather?"
"Yes. Except he waited all his life, and his chance never came. After Yoshitsune grew up, the faithful Genji followers who had looked after him during his childhood got the opportunity they had prayed for. I'll have a chance to make up for my grandfather, won't I?"
I think it's possible. Yes, I really think so."
He pulled Iori to him, lifted him up, and balanced him on his hands and feet like a ball. "Now try being a great man," he laughed. Iori giggled and stammered,
You're a goblin too! Stop it! I'll fall!
He reached down and pinched Musashi's nose. On the 11th day, it finally stopped raining. Musashi chafed to be out in the open, but it was another week before they were able to return to work under a bright sun. The field they had so arduously carved out of the wilderness had disappeared without a trace. In its place were rocks and a river where none had been before. The water seemed to mock them, just as the villagers had. Iori, seeing no way to reclaim their loss, looked up and said,
"This place is beyond hope. Let's look for better land somewhere else."
"No," Musashi said firmly. "With the water drained off, this would make excellent farmland. I examined the location from every angle before I chose it."
"What if we have another heavy rain?"
"We'll fix it so the water doesn't come this way. We'll lay a dam from here all the way to that hill over there."
"That's an awful lot of work."
"You seem to forget that this is our dojo. I'm not giving up a foot of this land until I see barley growing on it."
Musashi carried on his stubborn struggle throughout the winter, into the second month of the new year. It took several weeks of strenuous labor to dig ditches, drain the water off, pile dirt for a dike, and then cover it with heavy rocks. 3 weeks later, Everything was again washed away.
Look, Iori said, we're wasting our energy on something impossible. Is that the way of the sword?
The question struck close to the bone, but Musashi would not give in. Only a month passed before the next disaster, a heavy snowfall followed by a quick thaw. Iori, on his return from trips to the temple for food, inevitably wore a long face, for the people there rode him mercilessly about Musashi's failure. And finally, Musashi himself began to lose heart. For 2 full days and on into a third, he sat silently brooding and staring at his field. Then it dawned on him suddenly. Unconsciously, he had been trying to create a neat, square field like those common in other parts of the Kanto Plain. But this was not what the terrain called for. Here, despite the general flatness, there were slight variations in the lay of the land and the quality of the soil that argued for an irregular shape.
"What a fool I've been!" he exclaimed aloud. "I tried to make the water flow where I thought it should, and forced the dirt to stay where I thought it ought to be. But it didn't work. How could it? Water's water, dirt's dirt. I can't change their nature. What I've got to do is learn to be a servant to the water and a protector of the land."
In his own way, he had submitted to the attitude of the peasants. On that day, he became a nature's manservant. He ceased trying to impose his will on nature and let nature lead the way, while at the same time seeking out possibilities beyond the grasp of other inhabitants of the plain. The snow came again, and another thaw. The muddy water oozed slowly over the plain, but Musashi had had time to work out his new approach, and his field remained intact.
"The same rules must apply to governing people," he said to himself.
In his notebook, he wrote, "Do not attempt to oppose the way of the universe, but first make sure you know the way of the universe."
Mountain Devils.
"Let me make myself clear. I don't want you to go to any trouble on my account. Your hospitality, which I appreciate greatly, is quite sufficient."
"Yes, sir. That's very considerate of you, sir," replied the priest.
"I'd just like to relax, that's all."
"By all means."
"Now, I hope you'll forgive my rudeness," said the samurai, stretching out casually on his side and propping his graying head on his forearm.
The guest who'd just arrived at the Tokuganji was Nagaoka Sado, a high-ranking vassal of Lord Hosokawa Tadaoki of Buzen. He had just time for personal matters, but he invariably came on such occasions as the anniversary of his father's death, usually staying overnight, since the temple was some 20 miles from Edo. For a man of his rank, he traveled unostentatiously, accompanied this time by only 2 samurai and 1 young personal attendant. To get away from the Hosokawa establishment even for a short time, he had had to trump up an excuse. He rarely had the chance to do as he pleased, and now that he did, he was fully enjoying the local sake while listening to the croaking of frogs. Briefly, he could forget about everything. The problems of administration and the constant need to be attuned to the nuances of daily affairs. After dinner, the priest quickly cleared the dishes and left. Sado was chatting idly with his attendants, who were seated next to the wall, only their faces showing in the light of the lamp.
"I could just lie here forever and enter nirvana like the Buddha," Sado said lazily.
"Careful you don't catch cold. The night air is damp."
"Oh, leave me alone. This body survived a few battles. It can hold its own against a sneeze or two. But just smell those ripe blossoms. Nice fragrance, isn't it?"
"I don't smell anything."
"Don't you? If your sense of smell is that poor, you sure you don't have a cold yourself?"
They were engrossed in this kind of seemingly light banter when suddenly the frogs fell silent and a loud voice shouted,
"You devil!
What are you doing here, staring into the guest room?
Sato's bodyguards were on their feet instantly.
What is it? Who's out there?
As their cautious eyes scanned the garden, the clatter of small feet receded in the direction of the kitchen. A priest looked in from the veranda, bowed, and said,
Sorry for the disturbance. It's only one of the local children. There's nothing to worry about.
Are you sure?
Yes, of course. He lives a couple of miles from here. His father worked as a groom until he died recently, but his grandfather is said to have been a samurai, and every time he sees one, he stops and stares, with his finger in his mouth.
Sato sat up.
You mustn't be too hard on him. If he wants to be a samurai, bring him in. We'll have some sweets and talk it over.
By now, Iori had reached the kitchen.
Hey, Granny, he shouted. I've run out of millet. Fill this up for me, will you?
The sack he thrust out to the wrinkled old woman who worked in the kitchen would have held half a bushel. She shouted right back,
Watch your tongue, you beggar! You talk as if we owe you something.
You've got a lot of nerve to begin with,
said a priest who was washing dishes.
The head priest took pity on you, so we're giving you food, but don't be insolent. When you're asking a favor, do it politely.
I'm not begging. I gave the priest the pouch my father left me. There's money in it, plenty of money.
And how much could a groom living out in the sticks leave his son?
Are you going to give me the millet? Yes or no?
There you go again. Just look at yourself. You're crazy, taking orders from that fool Ronin. Where did he come from anyway? Who is he? Why should he be eating your food?
None of your business.
Humph. Digging around in that barren plain where there's never ever going to be a field or a garden or anything else. The whole village is laughing at you.
Who asked for your advice?
Whatever is wrong with that Ronin's head must be catching. What do you expect to find up there? A pot of gold, like in a fairy tale? You're not even dry behind the ears, and you're already digging your own grave.
Shut up and give me the millet! The millet! Now!
The priest was still teasing Iori a couple of minutes later when something cold and slimy hit his face. His eyes popped, then he saw what it was, a warty toad. He screamed and lunged for Iori, but just as he collared him, another priest arrived to announce that the boy was wanted in the samurai's room. The head priest had also heard the commotion and rushed to the kitchen.
"Did he do something to upset our guest?"
he asked worriedly.
"No, Sato just said he'd like to talk to him. He'd like to give him some sweets, too."
The head priest hurriedly took Iori by the hand and delivered him personally to Sado's room. As Iori timidly sat down beside the priest, Sato asked,
"How old are you?"
13.
"And you want to become a samurai?"
"That's right,"
replied Iori, nodding vigorously.
"Well, well. Why don't you come and live with me, then? You'd have to help with the housework at the beginning, but later I'd make you one of the apprentice samurai."
Iori shook his head silently. Sato, taking this for bashfulness, assured him that the offer was serious. Iori, flashing an angry look, said,
"I heard you wanted to give me some sweets. Where are they?"
Paling, the head priest slapped him on the wrist.
"Don't scold him," Sato said reprovingly.
He liked children and tended to indulge them.
"He's right. A man should keep his word. Have the sweets brought in."
When they arrived, Iori began stuffing them into his kimono. Sato, a little taken aback, said,
"Aren't you going to eat them here?"
"No. My teacher's waiting for me at home."
"Oh, you have a teacher?"
Without bothering to explain himself, Iori bolted from the room and disappeared through the garden. Sato thought his behavior highly amusing. Not so the head priest, who bowed to the floor two or three times before going to the kitchen in pursuit of Iori.
"Where is that insolent brat?
He picked up his sack of millet and left."
They listened for a moment, but heard only a discordant screeching. Iori had plucked a leaf from a tree and was trying to improvise a tune. None of the few songs he knew seemed to work. The groom's chanty was too slow, the bon festival songs too complicated. Finally, he settled on a melody resembling the sacred dance music at the local shrine. This suited him well enough, for he liked the dances, which his father had sometimes taken him to see. About halfway to Hotengahara, at a point where two streams joined to make a river, he gave a sudden start. The leaf flew from his mouth, along with a spray of saliva, and he leapt into the bamboo beside the road. Standing on a crude bridge were three or four men engaged in a furtive conversation.
"It's them," Iori exclaimed softly.
A remembered threat rang in his frightened ears. When mothers in this region scolded their children, they were apt to say, "If you're not good, the mountain devils will come down and get you." The last time they had actually come had been in the fall of the year before last. 20 miles or so from here, in the mountains of Hitachi, there was a shrine dedicated to a mountain deity. Centuries earlier, the people had so feared this god that the villagers had taken turns making annual offerings of grain and women to him. When a community's turn came, the inhabitants had assembled their tribute and gone in a torchlit procession to the shrine. As time went on, and it became evident that the god was really only a man, they became lax in making their offerings. During the period of the civil wars, the so-called mountain god had taken to having his tribute collected by force. Every 2 or 3 years, a pack of brigands, armed with halberds, hunting spears, axes, anything to strike terror into the hearts of peaceful citizens, would descend on first one community, then the next, carrying away everything that caught their fancy, including wives and daughters. If their victims put up any resistance, the plundering was accompanied by slaughter. Their last raid, still vivid in his memory, Iori cringed in the underbrush. A group of 5 shadows came running across the field to the bridge. Then, through the night mist, another small band, and still another, until the bandits numbered between 40 and 50. Iori held his breath and stared while they debated a course of action. They soon reached a decision. Their leader issued a command and pointed toward the village. The men rushed off like a swarm of locusts. Before long, the mist was rent by a great cacophony. Birds, cattle, horses, the wailing of people, young and old. Iori quickly made up his mind to get help from the samurai at the Tokuganji, but the minute he left the shelter of the bamboo, a shout came from the bridge. "Who's there?" He had not seen the 2 men left behind to stand guard. Swallowing hard, he ran for all he was worth, but his short legs were no match for those of grown men.
"Where do you think you're going?"
shouted the man who got hold of him first.
"Who are you?"
Instead of crying like a baby, which might have thrown the men off guard, Iori scratched and fought against the brawny arms imprisoning him.
"He saw all of us together. He was going to tell somebody.
Let's beat him up and dump him in the rice field."
"I've got a better idea."
They carried Iori to the river, threw him down the bank, and jumping down after him, tied him to one of the bridge posts.
"There, that takes care of him."
The 2 ruffians climbed back up to their station on the bridge. The temple bell tolled in the distance. Iori watched horrified as the flames rising from the village dyed the river a bloody red. The sound of babies crying and women wailing came closer and closer. Then wheels rumbled onto the bridge. 6 of the bandits were leading ox carts and horses loaded with loot.
"Filthy scum!" screamed a masculine voice.
"Give me back my wife!"
The scuffle on the bridge was brief but fierce. Men shouted, metal clanged, a shriek went up, and a bloody corpse landed at Iori's feet. A 2nd body splashed into the river, spraying his face with blood and water. 1 by 1, farmers fell from the bridge, 6 of them in all. The bodies rose to the surface and floated slowly downstream, but 1 man, not quite dead, grasped at the reeds and clawed the earth until he had pulled himself halfway out of the water.
"Hugh!" cried Iori. "Untie this rope! I'll go for help! I'll see that you get your revenge!"
Then his voice rose to a bellow.
"Come on! Untie me! I've got to save the village!"
The man lay motionless. Straining at his bonds with all his might, Iori finally loosened them enough to squirm down and kick the man in the shoulder. The face that turned toward his was blotched with mud and gore, the eyes dull and uncomprehending. The man crawled painfully closer. With his last ounce of strength, he undid the knots. As the rope fell loose, he collapsed and died. Iori looked cautiously up at the bridge and bit his lip. There were more bodies up there, but luck was with him. A cartwheel had broken through a rotten plank. The thieves, hurrying to pull it out, didn't notice his escape. Realizing he couldn't make it to the temple, Iori tiptoed along in the shadows until he reached a place shallow enough to cross. When he gained the other bank, he was on the edge of Hotengara. He covered the remaining mile to the cabin as though lightning was nipping at his heels. As he neared the knoll where the cabin stood, he saw that Musashi was standing outside, looking at the sky.
"Come quick!" he shouted.
"What happened?"
"We have to go to the village!"
"Is that where the fire is?"
"Yes, the mountain devils have come again."
"Devils? Bandits?"
"Yes, at least 40 of them. Please hurry, we have to rescue the villagers."
Musashi ducked into the cabin and emerged with his swords. While he was tying his sandals, Iori said,
"Follow me, I'll show you the way."
"No, you stay here."
Iori couldn't believe his ears. "It's too dangerous."
"I'm not scared."
"You'd be in the way."
"You don't even know the shortest way there."
"The fire's all the guide I need. Now just be a good boy and stay right here."
"Yes, sir."
Iori nodded obediently, but with deep misgivings. He turned his head toward the village and watched somberly as Musashi streaked off in the direction of the red glow. The bandits had tied their female captives, moaning and screaming, in a row and were pulling them mercilessly toward the bridge.
"Stop your squawking," shouted one bandit. "You act like you don't know how to walk. Move!"
When the women held back, the ruffians lashed them with whips. One woman fell, dragging down others. Seizing the rope and forcing them back on their feet, one man snarled,
"Stubborn bitches! What have you got to groan about? Stay here and you work like slaves the rest of your lives, all for a bit of millet. Look at you, nothing but skin and bones. You'll be a lot better off having fun with us."
Picking one of the healthier-looking animals, which were all heavily loaded with booty, they tied the rope to it and gave it a sharp slap on the rump. The slack in the rope was snapped up suddenly, and fresh shrieks rent the air as the women were yanked forward again. Those who fell were dragged along, with their faces scraping the ground.
"Stop!"
screamed one.
"My arms are coming off!"
A wave of raucous laughter swept through the brigands. At that moment, horse and women came to a dead halt.
"What's going on? Somebody's up ahead!"
All eyes strained to see.
"Who's there?"
roared one bandit. The silent shadow walking toward them carried a white blade. The bandits, trained to be sensitive to odors, instantly recognized the one they smelled now, blood dripping from the sword. As the men in front fell back clumsily, Musashi sized up the enemy force. He counted 12 men, all hard-muscled and brutish-looking. Recovering from the initial shock, they readied their weapons and took defensive stances. One ran forward with an axe. Another, carrying a hunter's spear, approached diagonally, keeping his body low and aiming at Musashi's ribs. The man with the axe was the first to go.
"Ah!"
Sounding as though he'd bitten his own tongue off, he weaved crazily and collapsed in a heap.
"Don't you know me?"
Musashi's voice rang out sharply.
"I am the protector of the people, a messenger from the god who watches over this village."
In the same breath, he seized the spear pointed at him, wrested it from its owner's hands, and threw it violently to the ground. Moving swiftly into the band of ruffians, he was kept busy countering thrusts from all sides. But after the first surge, made while they still fought with confidence, he had a good idea of what lay ahead. It was a matter not of numbers, but of the opposition's cohesiveness and self-control. Seeing one man after another turned into a blood-spurting missile, the bandits were soon falling back to ever greater distances, until finally they panicked and lost all semblance of organization. Musashi was learning even as he fought, acquiring experience that would lead him to specific methods to be used by a smaller force against a larger one. This was a valuable lesson and couldn't be learned in a fight with a single enemy. His two swords were in their scabbards. For years, he'd practiced to master the art of seizing his opponent's weapon and turning it against him. Now he'd put study into practice, taking the sword away from the first man he'd encountered. His reason wasn't that his own sword, which he thought of as his soul, was too pure to be sullied by the blood of common brigands. He was being practical. Against such a motley array of weapons, a blade might get chipped or even broken. When the five or six survivors fled toward the village, Musashi took a minute or two to relax and catch his breath, fully expecting them to return with reinforcements. Then he freed the women and ordered those who could stand to take care of the others. After some words of comfort and encouragement, he told them it was up to them to save their parents and children and husbands. "You'd be miserable if you survived and they perished, wouldn't you?" he asked. There was a murmur of agreement. "You yourselves have the strength to protect yourselves and save the others, but you don't know how to use that strength. That's why you're at the mercy of outlaws. We're going to change that. I'm going to help you by showing you how to use the power you have. The first thing to do is arm yourselves." He had them collect the weapons lying about and distributed one to each of the women. "Now follow me and do just as I say. You mustn't be afraid. Try to believe that the god of this district is on your side." As he led the women toward the burning village, other victims emerged from the shadows and joined them. Soon the group had grown into a small army of nearly 100 people. Women tearfully hugged loved ones, daughters were reunited with parents, wives with husbands, mothers with children. At first, as the women described how Musashi had dealt with the bandits, the men listened with shocked expressions on their faces, not believing that this could be the idiot Ronin of Hotengahara. When they did accept it, their gratitude was obvious, despite the barrier imposed by their dialect. Turning to the men, Musashi told them to find weapons. "Anything will do, even a good heavy stick or a length of fresh bamboo." No one disobeyed or even questioned his orders. Musashi asked, "How many bandits are there in all?"
"About 50.
"How many houses in the village?"
70.
Musashi calculated that there was probably a total of 700 or 800 people. Even allowing for old people and children, the brigands would still be outnumbered by as much as 10 to 1. He smiled grimly at the thought that these peaceful villagers had believed they had no recourse but to throw up their hands in despair. He knew that if something was not done, the atrocity would be repeated. Tonight, he wanted to accomplish two things: show the villagers how to protect themselves, and see that the brigands were banished forever.
"Sir," cried a man who had just come from the village, "they're on their way here."
Though the villagers were armed now, the news made them uneasy. They showed signs of breaking and running. To restore confidence, Musashi said loudly, "There's nothing to be alarmed about. I was expecting this. I want you to hide on both sides of the road, but first listen to my instructions." He talked rapidly, but calmly, briefly repeating points for emphasis. "When they get here, I'll let them attack me. Then I'll pretend to run away. They'll follow me. You, all of you, stay where you are. I won't need any help. After a time, they'll come back. When they do, attack. Make lots of noise. Take them by surprise.
Strike at their sides, legs, chests, any area that's unguarded. When you've taken care of the first bunch, hide again and wait for the next one. Keep doing this until they're all dead. He barely had time to finish and the peasants to disperse before the marauders appeared. From their dress and lack of coordination, Musashi guessed that theirs was a primitive fighting force, of a sort that might have been common long ago when men hunted and fished for sustenance. The name Tokugawa meant nothing to them, no more than did Toyotomi. The mountains were their tribal home. The villagers existed to provide them with food and supplies.
"Stop!"
ordered the man at the head of the pack. There were about 20 of them, some with crude swords, some with lances, one with a battle axe, another with a rusty spear. Silhouetted against the glow of the fire, their bodies looked like demonic, jet-black shadows.
"Is he the one?"
"Yeah, that's him, all right."
Some 60 feet ahead of them, Musashi stood his ground, blocking the road. Disconcerted, they began to doubt their own strength, and for a short time none of them moved. But only for a moment. Then Musashi's blazing eyes started to pull them inexorably toward them.
"You the son of a bitch trying to get in our way?"
"Right!"
roared Musashi, raising his sword and tearing into them. There was a loud reverberation, followed by a whirlwind fray in which it was impossible to make out individual movements. It was like a spinning swarm of winged ants. The rice fields on one side of the road and the embankment lined with trees and bushes on the other were ideal for Musashi, since they provided a measure of cover. But after the first skirmish, he executed a strategic withdrawal.
"See that? The bastard's running away! After him!"
They pursued him to a far corner of the nearest field, where he turned and faced them. With nothing behind him, his position seemed worse, but he kept his opponents at bay by moving swiftly to right and left. Then the moment one of them made a false move, Musashi struck. His dark form seemed to flit from place to place, a geyser of blood rising before him each time he paused. The bandits who were not killed were soon too dazed to fight, while Musashi grew sharper with every strike. It was a different sort of battle from the one at Ichijoji. He did not have the feeling of standing on the border between life and death, but he had reached a plane of selflessness, body and sword performing without the need of conscious thought. His attackers fled in complete disarray. A whisper went along the line of villagers, "They're coming!" Then a group of them jumped out of hiding and fell upon the first two or three bandits, killing them almost effortlessly. The farmers melted into the darkness again, and the process was repeated until all the bandits had been ambushed and slain. Counting the corpses bolstered the villagers' confidence.
"They're not so strong after all," gloated one man.
"Wait, here comes another one."
"Get him!"
"No, don't attack. It's the Ronin."
With a minimum of confusion, they lined up along the road like soldiers being reviewed by their general. All eyes were fixed on Musashi's bloody clothing and dripping sword, whose blade was chipped in a dozen places. He threw it away and picked up a lance.
"Our work's not done," he said. "Get yourselves some weapons and follow me. By combining your strength, you can drive the marauders out of the village and rescue your families."
Not one man hesitated. The women and children also found weapons and followed along. The damage to the village was not as extensive as they had feared, because the dwellings were set well apart. But the terrified farm animals were raising a great ruckus, and somewhere a baby was crying its lungs out. Loud popping noises came from the roadside, where the fire had spread to a grove of green bamboo. The bandits were nowhere in sight.
"Where are they?" asked Musashi.
"I seem to smell sake. Where would there be a lot of sake in one place?" The villagers were so absorbed in gaping at the fires that nobody had noticed the smell, but one of them said,
"Must be the village headman's house. He's got barrels of sake."
"Then that's where we'll find them," said Musashi.
As they advanced, more men came out of hiding and joined their ranks. Musashi was gratified by the growing spirit of unity.
"That's it there,"
said one man, pointing out a large house surrounded by an earthen wall. While the peasants were getting themselves organized, Musashi scaled the wall and invaded the bandits' stronghold. The leader and his chief lieutenants were ensconced in a large dirt-floored room, swilling sake and forcing their attentions on young girls they were holding captive.
"Don't get excited,"
the leader shouted angrily in a rough mountain dialect.
"He's only one man. I shouldn't have to do anything myself. The rest of you take care of him."
He was upbraiding an underling who had rushed in with the news of the defeat outside the village. As their chief fell silent, the others became aware of the hum of angry voices beyond the wall and stirred uneasily. Dropping half-eaten chickens and sake cups, they jumped to their feet and instinctively reached for their weapons. Then they stood there, staring at the entrance to the room. Musashi, using his lance as a pole, vaulted through a high side window, landing directly behind the chief. The man whirled around, only to be impaled on the lance. Letting out a fearsome, "Argh!" he grabbed with both hands the lance lodged in his chest. Musashi calmly let go of the lance, and the man toppled face down on the ground, the blade and most of the shaft projecting from his back. The second man to attack Musashi was relieved of his sword. Musashi sliced him through, brought the blade down on the head of a third man, and thrust it into the chest of a fourth. The others made helter-skelter for the door. Musashi hurled the sword at them, and in a continuation of the same motion, extricated the lance from the chief's body.
"Don't move!"
he bellowed. He charged with the lance held horizontally, parting the bandits like water struck with a pole. This gave him enough room to make effective use of the long weapon, which he now swung with a deftness that tested the very resiliency of its black oak shaft, striking sideways, slicing downward, thrusting viciously forward. The bandits attempting to get out the gate found their way blocked by the armed villagers. Some climbed the wall. When they hit the ground, most were slaughtered on the spot. Of the few who succeeded in escaping, nearly all received crippling wounds. For a time, the air was filled with shouts of triumph from young and old, male and female. And as the first flush of victory subsided, man and wife, parents and children, hugged each other and shed tears of joy. In the midst of this ecstatic scene, someone asked,
"What if they come back?"
There was a moment of sudden, anxious stillness.
"They won't be back," Musashi said firmly. "Not to this village. But don't be overconfident. Your business is using plows, not swords. If you grow too proud of your fighting ability, the punishment heaven will mete out to you will be worse than any raid by mountain devils."
"Did you find out what happened?"
Nagaoka Sado asked his two samurai when they got back to the Tokuganji. In the distance, across field and swamp, he could see that the light of the fires in the village was fading.
"Everything's quieted down now."
"Did you chase the bandits away? How much damage was done in the village?"
"The villagers killed all but a few of them before we got there. The others got away."
"Well, that's odd."
He looked surprised, for if this was true, he had some thinking to do about the way of governing in his own lord's district. On leaving the temple the following day, he directed his horse toward the village, saying,
"It's out of the way, but let's have a look."
A priest came along to show them the way, and while they rode, Sado observed,
"Those bodies along the roadside don't look to me as though they were cut down by farmers,"
and asked his samurai for more details. The villagers, foregoing sleep, were hard at work, burying corpses and cleaning up debris from the conflagration. But when they saw Sado and the samurai, they ran inside their houses and hid.
"Get one of the villagers to come here, and let's find out exactly what happened," he said to the priest.
The man who came back with the priest gave them a fairly detailed account of the night's event.
"Now it begins to make sense," Sado said, nodding. "What's this Ronin's name?"
The peasant, never having heard Musashi's name, cocked his head to one side. When Sato insisted on knowing it, the priest asked about for a time and came up with the required information.
Miyamoto Musashi,